from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Today is not only the busiest travel day of the year, it also leads into one of the busiest cooking days of the year. In our next hour forum, author Harold McGee joins us. He writes the Curious Cook column for the New York Times, and his new book is called Keys to Good Cooking, a guide to making the best of foods and recipes. He'll join us to offer guidance on Thanksgiving and beyond. To brine or not to brine? That's the question, and Harold McGee has the answer. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. New York Times food columnist and author Harold McGee has always been interested in the science of cooking. He is as curious about chemistry as he is all things culinary. While at Yale, he completed a doctoral thesis called Keats and the Progress of Tastes. It was strangely exhilarating to see such intellectual firepower aimed at the kneading of bread dough, he once wrote, or the mitigation of the gassy effects of beans. Harold McGee's column, The Curious Cook, appears regularly in the New York Times. He's the author of the award-winning On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. And his new book is titled The Keys to Good Cooking. And he joins us now on this Thanksgiving Eve. Harold McGee, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Happy to have you with us. So let's get right to the great turkey questions as people are contemplating how they're going to deal with that big bird tomorrow. And you have observed that with turkeys, you have to compromise. How come?
Well, it's a really tough job because a turkey is has two different kinds of meat on it. The breast meat, which is kind of delicate, and the leg meat, which is kind of tough. And to get both of them done just right in the same oven, cooking for the same amount of time, is it's a real challenge.
Well, you have a tip for that in part, which I just discovered reading through your book, and that's to do what with the breast?
It's to ice it down while the rest of the bird is coming up to room temperature. Turns out that you want about a 15-degree differential in end temperatures in the breast and the legs, and there are various ways to kind of try to manipulate that to, you know, turn the bird around and tent the breast and baste the breast and all these things. It struck me that you could try to get the bird into the oven with that differential built in, and so if you let the legs warm up and keep the breast cold, that's one way to help yourself out.
So, but you do want the bird, you take the bird out of the fridge and get it to be room temp, but pack ice around the breast so that there is that built-in. Fascinating.
That's right, yeah.
And what about positions? I mean, some people advocate turning the bird upside down so the breast is down. Is that also something that helps deal with that differential between the breast meat and the thighs?
Yeah, as long as you have the bird on a rack so that it's not in direct contact with the bottom of the pan, that does help because that way the breast is shielded from the direct heat of the oven walls and ceiling and floor while the legs are exposed. They're right out there. So that is another way to help yourself out.
And what about stuffing? There's always, you know, that's another dilemma about if you stuff the bird or not, and what one gets too goopy, one's too dry. What's your recommendation on that?
Well, the big difference between stuffed and unstuffed is that while stuffing the bird gets all those wonderful juices into the stuffing, it also pretty much guarantees that you're going to overcook the breasts in order to get the stuffing up to the proper temperature. So my feeling is if the stuffing is the most important thing, go ahead and stuff the bird. If the bird is the most important thing, then do the stuffing separately.
So it's a whole series of compromises you're contending with.
Yeah. You have to kind of make a little decision tree in your mind and decide how exactly you want to proceed.
So if you assume for a moment that your key, what you care about most is getting the breast meat just right, then don't stuff the bird, turn it upside down, chill the breast, and you're on your way?
Yeah, but none of those things is a guarantee. So what you have to do in addition to all those things is what you have to do no matter what, and that's to check the doneness early and often. No recipe can give you an accurate timing for the doneness of anything, really, turkeys especially. So you just need to get a ballpark idea from the numbers that are published in newspapers at this time of year. But then, like an hour, 2 hours before that, go ahead and check and see where you are, because it may be cooking faster. And you have a relatively narrow window in which to get it just right. You're shooting for about a 10-degree range inside the breast, and the oven temperature is at 350, 400, something like that. So you don't have a lot of time to get it just right.
And what should the breast temperature read?
Ideally around 150. A little bit one side or the other of that won't hurt, but that's about the point where it's at its juiciest.
And do you, once it hits that point, do you pull it out, or is it supposed to stay at 150 degrees for a certain amount of time?
Well, no, you want to pull it out, because even when you do pull it out, the temperature is going to continue to rise a little bit, simply because the outer parts of the bird are still hotter than the inside. So pull it out at 150 or even a couple of degrees below that, and then just let it sit at room temperature.
Harold McGee is our guest this hour. His new book is called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. One more turkey question, and then we can maybe move on to at least other aspects of the Thanksgiving Day menu. But what about the great brining question? This seems to be something that everyone talks about to a degree. Do you brine?
Well, I have in the past, and I brine no longer. And there again, it really is a question of what exactly you want. Brining definitely does help you get a moister, juicier, harder to overcook turkey.
Describe what it is first, how you go about brining.
Okay. So you add salt to water. Sometimes people will add some other seasonings as well. Sometimes they'll add a little bit of fruit juice to give more flavor. And then you essentially immerse the turkey in that liquid, salt water, for several days. And that's something that it's important to realize, is that brining is something you have to think of ahead of time.
So if you haven't done it by now, don't do it?
Well, if you do it now, it'll make a bit of a difference, but mainly in the outer parts of the bird. It takes quite a while for the brine actually to penetrate into the depths of the meat.
But you say you no longer do. So how come? What's the price you pay for brining?
The price you pay is the usability of the pan juices, which will end up very salty. If you think about it, you're essentially filling the bird up with salt water, and when you cook it, birds lose juices, and those juices are now pretty salty. And also, to me, the flavor of a brined turkey breast tastes to me more like kind of deli turkey meat than it does Thanksgiving turkey meat. And that's, you know, just a matter of my experience. I grew up not having brined turkey for Thanksgiving, and so it's a personal sort of thing. But I really love to make gravy and pan juices. To me, that's one of the highlights of Thanksgiving, and I'd like to have those as I'd like to be able to adjust the saltiness of that and not just have them very salty to begin with.
And what's the secret to that, to making gravy? What's the art involved in having that turn out the way one would like?
Well, the best thing to do is to let the juices brown on the bottom of the pan as the turkey is cooking, and then what's called deglaze the pan by taking the pan out, taking the bird and the rack out, and then setting the pan over a couple of burners, one burner if it's not too big a pan, and then put it on gentle heat. Pour in some wine, white wine, or just water if you'd prefer, and heat that liquid. Get those wonderful, flavorful, crusty bits off the bottom of the pan, and then adjust the seasoning a little bit. Thicken with a little bit of flour or cornstarch, which you can treat various ways. You can toast it ahead of time to get a little more flavor. And thicken it just barely, just so that it coats the back of a spoon. One of the most common errors people will make is to over-thicken the gravy, and that ends up making it harder to get the flavor.
If you don't brine, and do you, what do you baste with instead? And does that affect what you wind up with in terms of your gravy making resources?
Well, basting is an interesting process, and it depends on what you baste with, you know, what the effect is. So if you baste with a water-based liquid like stock or the juices from the bottom of the roasting pan, then that actually cools down the breast momentarily and slows the cooking. Mm. And that's a good thing because you want the breast to cook less than the legs. But if you, for example, brush with butter, that ends up speeding up the heating of the breast because the oil actually improves the heat transfer from the oven to the breast. So you need to be careful about which kind of liquid you use.
I want to open up our phone lines and emails early if you have a question about not just Thanksgiving Day, but if you have turkey, cranberry, mashed potato, green beans, stuffing questions for Harold McGee, you can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, forum@kqed.org. Or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments online, and we'll slip those into our dialogue. I want to get to many of the other topics, obviously, you treat. I don't want to make it sound like your new book is all about turkey. but before we get to the rest of that, I'm just curious, what are you going to make tomorrow?
So I celebrate and have celebrated Thanksgiving for years now with Indian friends of mine. And so the deal is it's a big potluck, 20-odd people. I bring a turkey, and they do all these wonderful, exotically spiced side dishes.
And so is that something people you'd suggest think about? I mean, that you can still have maybe the traditional turkey, but embellish that? What does turkey go with? I mean, are there lots of more exotic things that it works well in combination with?
Well, yeah, all kinds of things. For example, rice dishes, pilaf. Not with any meat in it because you've already got plenty of meat, but something that's wonderfully spiced with Eastern spices, cinnamon and cloves and things like that. Things that we associate more with desserts, but which for centuries were actually used in savory dishes as well in Europe as well as in the East.
Let's take a few of our calls already. People wanting to get in on this question. A call arriving from Donner Summit. I'm glad you made it at least that far. I hope you're not stuck in the snow on I-80. Go ahead, caller, please.
Yeah, we're sure stuck in traffic, hardly moving along at all.
And your question for Harold McGee.
The question is, we're thinking of deep frying our turkey this year. We have a friend who's doing a fundraiser for Berkeley Elementary School who's going to deep fry our turkey. Do you think that'll overcome the problems that happen with the heat being maldistributed to the breast and the leg?
So deep frying a turkey is it's a challenge. It's different and it's wonderful. I've done it a few times. And
how do you go about that? I mean, this is a sizable thing to deep fry.
Yeah. Well, in fact, one of the most important things to do is not to get too big a turkey. So I'd say 12 to 14 pounds is really as high as you want to go. But that said, it's a very efficient way, a very quick way to cook because the transfer is right from the hot oil into the turkey itself, and it happens inside the cavity as well as outside. And the great thing about that is the shorter the period of time that the meat is subjected to hot temperatures, the less time it has to dry out. So it does work very well. But I would still recommend that pre-icing of the breasts.
And so how long does that process take to deep fry a turkey?
It depends on the initial temperature of the turkey, the temperature of the oil, the size of the turkey, but much less time than oven roasting, on the order of an hour or so.
Josh, I hope you make it to wherever you're heading from I-80 and that you have time. Sounds like it would be an efficient way to make your turkey by way of deep frying. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Let's go next to Mark in San Francisco with another cooking question about how to cook a turkey. Mark, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I am a big believer in cooking a turkey in the bag that they sell. You can get nylon or some material, and it cuts the cooking time and seems to come out perfectly. I wonder what you think about that.
That's actually something I've never done with a turkey. I've done it with chickens, and you're right, it does work well. It's it is a nylon bag, and the heat gets through via radiation, heat radiation through the bag itself, and that is a way to do it. It does work.
Mark, thanks. And another Mark in Atherton is next. Mark, go ahead.
Yes, I've got a question and also a comment after I've been listening to you. When I stuff my turkey, it always comes out too wet. How do I keep it on the drier side? And then also a comment, you mentioned that the breasts get cooked too fast, and so you should baste them. But if you use oil, that it speeds it up. So what about basting the breast with the juices to cool it down, and then also cover the or coat the legs with butter to speed that up? Would that help?
Yeah, that's actually a great idea to have oil on one part, oil or fat, either one, on the legs to speed up the cooking, and then water-based liquid of some kind to slow it down on the breast. That's a very good idea. And then as far as the soggy stuffing on the inside, that is a tough one these days especially because many turkeys, if you look at the label, it'll say up to 3% added water, and that's so not only are we paying for that added water, but when it comes out, it ends up making the stuffing soggier than it would be. One thing I would suggest is to take the turkey out ahead of time, like right now, since tomorrow is Thanksgiving, and let it dry out. Just leave it unwrapped in the refrigerator, and that will dry it out and reduce that problem.
But not at room temperature. Leave it in the fridge.
The fridge.
Okay. Yeah. Mark, thanks. Thanks for the call. But again, your primary recommendation sounded like on stuffing was don't stuff it. I mean, cook the stuffing separately?
Well, cook the stuffing separately if you want succulent breast meat. But if you really love that deeply turkeyed flavor of the stuffing itself, then I would go ahead and do that and then add a lot of gravy to the breast.
We're being overwhelmed here with turkey questions. I'm going to work my way through as many as I can here coming in on email. Is it okay to brine a whole turkey that hasn't been fully defrosted? Mm-hmm. If you're going to roast the turkey in parts instead of the whole bird, is it better to brine it whole first or brine it after it's been cut up into pieces? So I guess two questions here. Brining if it hasn't been fully defrosted and also brining parts as opposed to the whole.
Yeah. It is okay to go ahead and brine it if it's partly defrosted. You're going to end up with less penetration of the salt. It's going to take longer. But it's okay to go ahead and do that. And in fact, that will help speed the defrosting process. And then the second one was
sorry, I had to lean down and pick up the email. Sorry about that. I've drifted off mic for a moment. Whether you can do it in parts. Can you just brine one part of the turkey and not the rest?
Yes, indeed you can. And in fact, that also will speed the brining of the bird. Get the because you've opened up more surfaces for the brine to get into, that'll make the brining go faster.
Here's someone who has a pumpkin pie question, so we're going to veer off turkey for a moment. May I use real cream or milk to make pumpkin pies, or must I use the canned variety? I think I used real cream and added a bit more sugar 1 year, and the results were good. Any thoughts?
Mm-hmm. The only thing you have to be concerned about there is the relative proportion of water that you're adding. If it's a condensed milk, then it's concentrated and there's less water. And so if you are going to use cream instead, you might want to add a little bit less.
And do call us if you have questions about things other than turkey, if you're interested in questions about other aspects of your Thanksgiving meal tomorrow or other things about Harold McGee's new book, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. Another caller writes in, this is in connection with Thanksgiving cooking as well as the latest Curious Cook article in the New York Times on using different oils in cooking. Mm-hmm. When used for deep frying, I understand that most oils such as canola or corn should not be reused after extended period of frying at high temperature since they undergo hydrogenation process. Is there a certain duration of time to use a certain temperature after which oils should not be used again?
It's a That's a question without a definite kind of bright line. It really is a matter of gradations. And I would say the best way to decide is simply by the quality of the oil. If it's dark, if it has a kind of strong fried flavor already, if it's getting viscous, those are all signs that it's past its ideal point. But there is no kind of clear point at which it's no longer any good.
Donna writes in with a potato question. I want to avoid that last-minute peeling, boiling, mashing madness just before dinner. A friend recommended doing the potatoes early in the day and then putting them in a crock pot. What do you think? And you have – in the book, there's some tips about what you think makes for good mashed potatoes.
That's right. And one of the most important things is to mash them by hand rather than using a machine. If you apply too much mechanical force to potato cells, they break apart and then you end up with something that's more like Elmer's glue than mashed potatoes. So be gentle on them. The problem with making potatoes ahead of time and then finishing them at the last minute or reheating them is that they do develop secondary flavors. They taste different after a few hours than they do when they're freshly made. And so you might try it and see that there's nothing wrong with giving it a try, but you will notice a flavor difference. And then it's up to you whether that difference is meaningful or not.
What about using, whether it's a crock pot or there are these, you know, warming trays where you can keep things hot with hot water underneath them? Are those mm-hmm. useful ways of sort of timing the dinner, or do you run into the problems you just described?
Well, it does depend on the thing that you've made. But the important thing to remember is that, especially when you're making a feast with lots and lots of different things, that once something is cooked and then cools down to body temperature or even a bit higher than that, bacteria are going to start growing. And you need to be aware of that and either keep things warm enough to prevent that from happening or chill them and rewarm them so that you don't end up with a problem.
Here's someone who has some basting tips. Baste the turkey with a 50-50 mix of cranberry juice and water. The turkey will brown delightfully and the gravy will have a tart, sweet flavor.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a very interesting idea. I mean, you could do the same thing with wine, with apple juice, all kinds of things. And it's true that the sugars in these things will make the skin brown faster.
And Stephanie's other tip is gravy without lumps is obtained by putting flour into a jar of water and shaking it into a smooth roux and adding it to the juices after the fat has been siphoned off.
Mm-hmm. Actually, yeah, you want to make either a slurry, which is what I would call what that idea is. So it's a mixture of flour and water, cold water, because if you add flour to hot water, it will clump. Or you can make a roux, which is something different. You actually would take off some of the fat, put that into a pan, put the dry flour into the fat. It won't clump because it's fat, and then brown that, and that gives you a wonderful flavor to add to the gravy.
Harold McGee, our guest, the New York Times columnist, and a new book called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods. When we come back, we're going to talk about more of what's in the book. We'll continue to take your calls. We have a full menu of callers about almost all turkey questions. So we'll get in as many turkey questions as we can and talk with Harold McGee about the rest of what's in his book. He debunks a number of myths, has some interesting tips on the kind of tools you need in your kitchen, from something to weigh and not just measure, to different kinds of cutting boards, how to preheat, when to freeze, what to do with leftovers. We'll talk about all of that when we return. Here's the number again, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments there. Back with Harold McGee and more about cooking in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. Harold McGee is our guest. Again, he's the New York Times columnist, and he has a new book called Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and recipes. And you can join us at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. All of our phone lines are full with mostly turkey questions. We'll get back to those in a moment. But I want to ask you about the book. You said you wrote the book in part to be sort of the equivalent of Strunk and White's Elements of Style. Only someone who was a graduate student in English would have come up with that. But why did you want to write that, to be a kind of guide more than a recipe book?
Yeah, it seemed to me that we have millions of recipes and more all the time on the web and elsewhere. What we don't haven't had is a kind of central place to go just to find out the basics about ingredients, about how heat behaves in the kitchen, and then about particular kinds of dishes, just what's involved in their making and the kinds of decisions that can help you get the kind of result that you want. There are all kinds of different ways to get to a good result, and recipes make you think there's just that one.
Well, one of the things you mentioned, for example, is that you're a big believer in weighing things, not just measuring. Why is that important?
That's because when you measure something by volume, you're actually measuring the ingredient plus all the air that it comes along with. And when you measure by weight, you're measuring just the ingredient itself. And so my favorite example of the difference this can make is with salt. A tablespoon of granulated table salt weighs about 20 grams. There's about 20 grams of salt. A tablespoon of kosher salt weighs about 10 grams. Same volume, but half the actual salt content. So if you're measuring by volume, you're just not measuring clearly and accurately, and that can end up destroying a dish if you add too much salt. You can always adjust if there's not quite enough, but it can be devastating to the quality of a dish.
One of the things that's fun about your book is that you do have all of these suggestions about sort of the tools of the trade, whether that's a scale, the kinds of cutting boards you need, the kind of pans you need, all that sort of thing. And you're also – you do some myth debunking, like don't think that by searing meat you're sealing in the juices, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about what you had to say about natural and organic ingredients. And you write, be skeptical about alternative production claims – but not cynical. So how should we approach all of the marketing that is done now about being organic?
Yeah, it seems to me that the important thing is to pay attention to what packages and producers tell you, but always ask questions. As I say, be skeptical, because a lot of what's being said nowadays has more to do with marketing than with substance. And so if a package says free range, humanely raised, and that kind of thing, there is no official definition for those terms. So I would talk to the people at the grocery store, or go on the website and take a look at what's going on at that farm, just to see whether it's true.
And what about a claim like grass-fed beef? I mean, is that inherently better?
There are advantages and disadvantages. Some people just don't like the flavor because the flavor is very different. It is leaner, and so you have to cook it more carefully. The claim that's commonly made for it that I think is misleading is that it's said to have much more in the way of omega-3 fatty acids, which is technically true, but if you eat one walnut, you're going to get more than you will from a steak made from grass-fed beef.
So part of what's useful, I think, about this conversation that you're providing us with and the book is that you – to just think a little bit more, I guess. For example, you write that raw foods aren't necessarily more nutritious.
That's right. In fact, cooked foods are generally much more nutritious.
And microwave isn't a bad way to get that either, which is another sort of myth debunking element.
Exactly, exactly. So it does seem to me that foods and cooking are complicated. There are lots and lots of different ingredients, lots of ways to treat them, lots of ways they can come out. And we tend to do things kind of on autopilot. And in fact, the more we actually think about what we're doing and what we want and how to get it, I think the happier and better fed we'll be.
Again, the book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. And you can find out a lot about all of these various myths that are debunked and the kinds of things you need to think about, from how to preheat to using a microwave to the types of pans in Harold McGee's new book. Let's get back to our calls. And guess what? A turkey question. Joran in Sacramento. Go ahead, please.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Many recipes for poultry, roasted poultry, suggest salting, peppering the inside of the cavity, which you never eat. I was wondering if there's any science behind that or if it's just tradition.
That's a good question. And so salting and peppering the cavity will, of course, season the cavity. And some people, if they don't actually eat parts of that during the first use of the food, they may actually go ahead and use it to make a stock or a soup or something like that. And it can make a difference at that point. Something like pepper also has an aroma. And as the bird heats up, that aroma will fill the oven. And that can make a contribution to the rest of the meat.
Jordan, thanks for the call. Now, this is a difficult one. I'll just give you fair warning because you're going to wade into a family dispute.
Uh-oh.
Shoshana writes in, once I showed up to Thanksgiving and my parents were arguing. My mother had brined the turkey in rock salt instead of kosher salt, and my father was claiming it was inedible since rock salt isn't for eating. She thought he was crazy and cooked the bird anyway. He went out and bought a pre-cooked one, and we all got to choose the dangerous turkey or the safe one. I would love to show up tomorrow with an answer to this unsolved feud. What do you think? Is rock salt a safe thing to brine turkey?
Well, it's hard to say. That's why there's a dispute.
Now that's
right?
No answer.
that's the problem with a lot of questions is there is no clear answer. If I had the time to do a chemical analysis on that rock salt, then I could give you an answer. But in the absence of that, it is true that rock salt is not intended for human consumption, and so it's not as carefully regulated and analyzed as other salts. And so I wouldn't make a habit of it. It was probably okay. Once is not gonna kill you, but it is better to use something that is intended for human consumption.
All right, Shoshana, there you go. You are armed with evidence tomorrow to take to your parents. Let's take another call. Laura in Oakland joins us next. Laura, go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about another kind of dietary myth, maybe, I'm not sure, related to breastfeeding. I wonder if you have any opinion about things like beans or broccoli that you're not supposed to eat while you're breastfeeding because it will supposedly give the baby gas. Is there any truth to this?
That's news to me. I'm a firm believer in experiments, you know? So I would give it a try. And if you notice an effect, then I would change my behavior accordingly.
Right. Thank you.
All right, Laura. Thanks for the call. You, in your book, you cite a sort of famous story, which you thought was an old wives' tale, but turned out not to be, which is that Julia Child's claim that whipping up egg whites in a copper bowl is better. And you, as someone familiar with science, thought, well, that doesn't make any sense scientifically, but...
Yeah. So I made the mistake of dismissing it just on that basis without actually doing the experiment. And then years later came upon an illustration from an old French book showing somebody cooking or whipping egg whites in a copper bowl. So I thought, well, if it's a few hundred years old, maybe I should give it a look. And then discovered doing it side by side that there is a tremendous difference.
And why would that be if it's not the actual chemical properties of copper?
Well, it is the chemical properties, but it's not the acidity. Julia Child said the copper makes the egg whites acidic, and I knew enough chemistry to know that's not the case. But it turns out that there's a protein in the egg whites that in the chick carries metals from one part of the body to another, iron and things like that. It can also handle copper, and when it binds copper, its properties change, and the color changes as well, which is an indication that protein has picked up the copper.
One thing you mentioned in the book, which I didn't know, and I'm admittedly not at all knowledgeable about all things culinary, but that it's not just whether a pan is cast iron or copper or whatever. It's also the size of the pan matters, that you need to be sort of pan appropriate, I guess, when you cook.
That's right, because if you think about sautéing, for example, or frying, if the pan is very, very big and the amounts of food are very small, then on the flame, there are going to be parts of the pan without food covering it, and those parts are going to get super hot because there's nothing absorbing the heat there. Then when you move the food around or flip it, it can scorch on those hot spots. Conversely, if it's too small a pan, then you won't end up frying at all. It'll end up stewing.
This brings up something else, and then we'll get back to our calls about one of your recommendations is you really have to learn your stove and know how whether when it says 350, it's really 350. You also have to learn your refrigerator, that there are parts of the refrigerator that are colder than others. Again, total news to me.
Yeah, yeah. And there are things that you want to keep very cold, other things that you don't want to keep that cold at all. Meats and fish and milk are best kept as cold as possible, but many fruits and vegetables are better at something more like 45 or 50.
So what's the coldest part of the fridge?
It depends on how your fridge is built, but it's usually the part that's closest to the freezer. So in mine, which has a freezer at the bottom, it's actually at the bottom of the vegetable and meat drawers.
But figure this out. I mean, again, use a thermometer. Figure out literally sort of where the cold spots are.
Yeah. And
same with a stove. I mean, figure out where the hot spots are within a stove, also whether it's accurate.
Yeah, exactly. And there are these wonderful thermometers you can get now that are point and shoot and that measure the temperature of the surface just instantaneously. It's the same technology that you can now use to take the temperature of a baby through the ear canal. And so if you use that, you can, in a minute, get 30 different readings and really get a sense of the landscape, the temperature landscape of the inside of your refrigerator.
And what about within the stove? I mean, are there hot spots within the stove? Do you have to sort of, I'm going to put the turkey here versus there?
Indeed, yeah. The sides, the ceiling, the floor, and the center are all at very different temperatures. And then the air temperature varies as the heating elements come on and off.
And how do you figure that out?
Again, by taking temperatures and then with these infrared thermometers, what I do is put a dull object of some kind, like a ceramic cup, in the middle of the oven and let it heat up and then see what its temperature is after 15 or 20 minutes and compare that to the thermostat setting.
Here's someone who's challenging you. Are you sure about the 150-degree internal breast temperature? We've always heard that a higher temperature is needed for poultry, 160 when removing, that will reach 165 as it continues to warm on the counter.
So 165 is the official USDA temperature, which is has a built-in large margin for error. And if you're using a good thermometer and if juiciness is important to you, then you should know that 140 is actually perfectly safe. 150 is still has a good safety buffer built into it.
But have a good thermometer. And what is a good thermometer? How do you know how to buy one?
A good thermometer these days is not the old dial so-called instant read thermometers that cost less than $10. And if you look at a bunch of them in the store, they're likely all to read slightly different temperatures. Get a digital thermometer with as thin a probe as possible. That's going to give you the quickest, most accurate reading.
Are those generally available? Local hardware store? Do you have to go to some culinary specialty store?
They're easier to find in culinary stores, but more and more in hardware stores and other general stores.
And to Susan, who's listening today in Asheville, North Carolina. Susan, go ahead.
I'm going to cook rice pilaf on the stovetop for 24 people. The recipes that I find are for 6 to 8. So my question is, can I just double, triple, you know, and or multiply times 4 the water amounts and the rice amounts, or how do I need to vary that?
That's a good question, and it's going to depend on the kind of pot you use. We were talking earlier about the appropriateness of the size of a pot. What you want to do is take that into account and try to make sure that as much of the rice as possible is as close to the water as possible. So a big tall pot is going to give you mush at the bottom and undercooked rice at the top. You want something broad. And I would actually start with a little bit less water than 3 or 4 times and then add more if you need to, but you may end up not needing as much.
Susan, thanks for the call. That raises other questions about doubling and tripling. If you've got a big group, as you often do on Thanksgiving, can you readily, automatically double and triple? Or what do you have to think about when you're increasing the size of a particular item you're making?
Yeah. Well, you do need to think about the surface to volume ratios, because that does affect how quickly things either get moist or dry out, either one. And then seasonings often, for reasons that are not completely clear to me, they often don't scale the same way. You often need less seasoning. than you might think if you were just going to multiply the recipe.
Gina is next in Oakland. Gina, go ahead.
Hello. We usually barbecue our turkey outside, so we brine it first a couple of days and then barbecue it. I was wondering if you had any suggestions for that. And then also, can you stuff a barbecue turkey?
Yeah, there's no reason you can't. Barbecuing is essentially the same as oven roasting, except that the temperature is usually lower and the heat is dry and smoky and flavorful. But otherwise, the same basic physics apply.
Thanks for the call, Gina. Another family argument. You ready? My husband and I have an ongoing argument for more than three decades. He's Chinese, loves to cook, especially noodles and various kinds of broth. He insists on keeping, for example, a pot with a whole chicken that's been boiled for several hours on the stove overnight and or all day and heating it up every time he wants to use a bit for a meal. This goes against everything I've ever learned about safe food storage, and my blood boils in a Pavlovian response every time he does this.
Well, but it's been going on for three decades, and haven't gotten sick. So, so it's true that that's not the way the USDA would recommend that we handle our chickens, and not the way that I would recommend it either, because it does run a risk. On the other hand, if you're bringing it back to the boil frequently and frequently enough, and not opening it all the time so that it can get contaminated, then as you've discovered, it can be okay.
What about the question of how to refrigerate and leftovers in particular? A lot of people are going to have a lot left over tomorrow. Mm-hmm. People often will say, well, they want things to cool before they put them in the fridge. You advocate putting things in the fridge right away. Walk us through the best way to store leftovers.
Okay. Well, you really do want to let them cool down to some extent, because if you put hot things into the fridge, that's going to warm up everything else in the fridge, and then it's going to take a while to cool back down again, and that's not good. So you do want to go ahead and have your meal, but then instead of having that extra several glasses of wine and maybe letting the leftovers go until one in the morning or even the next morning, you do want to get them in within 4 hours or so of having taken them out of the oven or off the stovetop. And in that time, they will have cooled down to approximately room temperature. That's a good temperature at which to put them into the fridge.
And what about the best way to contain them? Are there containers that are better for leftovers also with freezing?
Well, when it comes to containers, anything that's airtight so that you don't end up getting refrigerator smells into the food will work. But a general principle is the smaller the container, the better, because the more bits that the food is divided up into, the faster all of it will cool down.
And let's go to Christine next. Christine, go ahead, please.
Hi. I have two different recipes for pumpkin pie. One of them calls for a pre-baked crust, and the other one doesn't. And I want to know which would be better and why.
It's not that either one is going to be better. It's that, you know, one is easier than the other and easier to control as well, because, getting a crust and filling done the way you want them at the same time is a difficult thing, or not as easy as using a pre-baked crust. So I would simply choose the one that's going to fit best in your flow of work tomorrow.
And you've got a whole section in the book on pastry and pie making as well. Again, the book, by the way, is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Harold McGee, the New York Times columnist as well, is our guest. This hour, we have time to squeeze in a number of more calls, so we'll try to work our way through those in our last 5-6 minutes or so. Allison, you're next.
Hi.
Go ahead, Allison.
Sorry. Thanks. I actually have another little bit of a food feud. My father is from England, and so every get-together we try to make Yorkshire pudding, and sort of part of the tradition is that it always fails.
Well, you don't want to mess with that.
I know. My sister actually has a boastful story that last year she got it to work by secretly adding baking soda or baking powder. And we're wondering, because that made us think, if European flour is different and if it has an additive that they don't add in the U.S.
No, I don't think, and especially back when Yorkshire pudding was invented, which was centuries ago, they weren't adding secret powders to the flour. It's true that if you're going to do that kind of thing, I would do it with baking powder, not baking soda, because the powder has acid and alkaline ingredients together. If you add just baking soda, then it's going to taste funny. That will help. But the thing you want to do is just make sure that the oven is hot enough. You want essentially you get the puff from all the moisture in the batter vaporizing and making a big cloud, a big puff. And for that to happen, the temperature has to be good and high.
So this is another gets us back to making sure you know your oven. Part of the problem may be that.
Yeah, exactly. And also separating the – I don't know how they make it, but separating the Yorkshire pudding making from anything else. Don't try to do that in the turkey at the same time because the turkey needs a lower temperature.
Allison, thanks. Good luck. Hope it all works out for you tomorrow. Carolyn is next in Menlo Park. Carolyn, go ahead.
Hi. My question is about stuffing. I'd like to make a very traditional stuffing, but with no meat or sausage in it. And I'm wondering what the major ingredients are for a very traditional stuffing.
Oh, you can find lots and lots of good vegetarian stuffings on the web just by searching for that exactly. But essentially, it's cubes of bread. All can be any kind of bread, including cornbread. And then some kind of flavorful liquid. And again, if you're going to make it vegetarian, you're not going to use stock. You'll want to find something else that some other kind of flavor that you enjoy. And then nuts and sage. Sage is sort of the flavoring for Thanksgiving turkey. That'll give you that special note. And then the rest is kind of up to you.
When I was growing up, my mom always used egg twist bread. I don't know why I even remember this for stuffing. And you're saying, in a sense, it probably doesn't matter, but there's also a certain value in maintaining, I think, those traditions, do you think?
Oh, yeah, because the different breads have very different flavors, and in the case of cornbread, very different textures. And that's those are the kinds of things that can kind of bring you back to happier times or to happy times and just make that connection.
Rebecca wants to know, I'm cooking a heritage turkey for the first time. I'd love to hear any advice Mr. McGee has on how those birds need to be prepared. I don't even know what a heritage turkey is. So start with that if you would.
Okay. Well, that's another area where marketing can sometimes be misleading. And we need to know who's producing it. There are turkeys that are not the modern turkey, but are a slightly less modern turkey. And then there are the turkeys that are breeds that do go back for decades and centuries, and they tend to be much smaller birds, much leaner birds, and you need to watch the temperature more carefully. They cook faster, and so you want to use that good thermometer often to make sure that you're not overcooking it.
Sandy in Stuart, Florida. Sandy, go ahead.
Yes, I have a question regarding butterflying a turkey before roasting it. I watched a couple of videos on the internet this morning about butterflying the turkey, and I wanted your opinion on that.
And if you would also, Harold, explain what that means.
Well, in fact, I'm not quite clear on what exactly that means. Does that mean because a turkey compared to a leg of lamb, for example, is a very complex structure. So does that mean taking the breasts off?
Sandy?
No. What it means is removing the entire backbone and then turning it over. You turn it over and you mash it down so that the breastbone splits, and then that's the way you roast it in that turned over position. It's supposed to make the white meat turn out better and more moist, and also less cooking time.
Okay. Sandy, thanks.
Yeah, so that does make sense. I've actually never seen this video or otherwise, and have never tried it myself. But it does make sense that by compacting it that way, you're going to make it easier for the heat to get into the breast from both sides, and that will speed the cooking.
I'm just going to read on the screen, and apologies, listeners, for not taking the rest of our calls, but we're short on time. Bacon or no bacon on the top of a turkey?
That will slow the cooking of the breast. It'll also prevent, though, the skin from browning.
Covering with foil or adding stock to prevent overcooking.
If you tent with foil, that will, again, reduce the heat transfer from the oven to the breast and slow its cooking.
And Grace writes in, what if you get caught with a turkey that doesn't totally thaw out? What do you do then?
You can go ahead and cook it without it having been totally thawed. But again, watch it carefully, and it's going to take a bit longer to cook.
We're approaching the end of our hour, our time with Harold McGee and his new book again, Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. What's the, I guess, most important advice that you'd like to leave people with, not only for Thanksgiving but the days beyond, that you think frequently gets ignored, that people don't think about enough? Is it to be too focused on the recipe and not understanding the kind of larger picture?
Well, something related to that. When things don't quite work in the kitchen, when we're following a recipe, we often think we've done something wrong. And it's often the recipe. And even when you have a good recipe, that's really it's a kind of a blueprint. You still have to reconstruct that recipe in your own kitchen with your own tools, your own stove, the ingredients that you happen to have. And no recipe is going to be able to cover all those details for you. So the more familiar you are with your own kitchen and with the way foods behave, the more likely you are to end up with a good result and want to cook again.
And maybe even a good result with Yorkshire pudding. We have someone else calling in with Yorkshire pudding advice, which is to use an electric beater and a copper bowl. So there you have it. Maybe you can, your next book can be Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to How to Resolve Family Disputes. Harold McGee, pleasure to have you on our program this morning.
Thank you, Dave.
Again, the book is Keys to Good Cooking, A Guide to Making the Best of Foods and Recipes. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. I'm Dave Iverson. Michael Krasny will be back with two pre-recorded programs tomorrow. He'll talk with Los Angeles Times columnist Michael Hiltzik in the opening hour, and then he'll have an interview with Philip Roth in the second hour tomorrow. That's coming up tomorrow on Thanksgiving morning. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.